Hello, happy new year, and welcome to our first IntraFish podcast of 2024. I'm editor Drew Cherry, joined today by executive editor John Fiorillo. What a year 2023 was. 2024 looks to be just as, if not more, turbulent. We have time to take a look at some of the top stories of 2023 and what we might expect for the coming year on those topics. So, John and I just got through looking at our roundup of the year, and it was difficult to narrow down exactly which ones had the most impact, but we think we gave we think we have a pretty good lineup here of ideas. So, John, let's start off talking about an issue that affects the entire value chain, and that's the decline in consumption, and that's the struggle of seafood at retail. You covered this a lot last year. Talk to us about what 2023 showed with retail numbers and what might be behind those.
Yeah, the lack of demand at retail is unprecedented. I mean, we have never seen anything like this in the modern era of the seafood industry. And by that, I mean probably the last 20 to 30 years. Now, it's important to note that this slack demand is not just in the US or the UK. It is literally global, which really astounds me, because it is like the entire world stopped eating seafood in 2023, or reduced in such a significant way their consumption. It's in Norway, it's throughout the European Union, certainly in North America, parts of South America. So when you have something that global, I mean, if you pardon the word, it's a pandemic of low demand. And when you have something that global, there's no way it can't upset the supply chain all the way back to the people who catch or farm the fish. So it was really something to watch the retail numbers come out. We have really good retail data from the United States and the EU and UK. It was month to month, you would just see the value would be increasing because of inflation and the higher prices, but the volumes would just steadily drop. Salmon was probably the one outlier that tend to maintain itself. It lost some ground later in the year, but it tended to buck the trend. But almost across every other species, it was just astounding. And like I said, unprecedented. So, you know, the question naturally on everybody's mind is 2024. And we can talk about that if you want now or whenever.
All right. Well, let's do that. The coming year, the United States at least dodged, it seems, a bullet on inflation. Not the rest of the world, not so much, but of course mixed. You know, ironically, seafood price inflation in some of these markets has not been as high as overall food inflation. Now that's kind of a plus and a minus, right? It's while that's a positive, one would think, to the pocketbooks, there's a perception that seafood is a premium price protein, and it is. But I think that is probably going to carry through. We have seen a lot of trading down to different formats in the UK, for example. The one category that did well in 2023 was fish fingers or fish sticks. By quite a bit compared to everything else sliding. So, all right, let's start looking at 2024, John, and where are you hearing from sources that things might be moving?
Well, there are some good signs, and then there are some less than good signs. Let me start with the probably the most concerning, and you just touched on it, is the trading down aspect. Inflation is easing, and new numbers just out today in the U.S. show it easing even more, which is great. But what consumers have learned to do over the last year in particular is trade down to, and when it comes to protein, obviously, trade down to cheaper proteins. In this case, chicken has become ridiculously cheaper, and pork has been cheaper almost throughout the year. So those two categories have benefited. Beef prices are still high, but beef kind of lives in a territory all its own. And even when prices are high, it can demand tends to be pretty steady. So on the overall battle in the protein department of grocery stores in particular, It 2024 doesn't look immediately promising. Now, what some good signs we are seeing. We're seeing shrimp imports to the U.S. I think over the last 4 months or maybe a little bit longer have been increasing after a period of stagnation and decrease. Why are they increasing? Well, right, producer prices are very low right now. So buyers in the U.S. and elsewhere are restocking their inventories and taking advantage of these lower prices. That's important because retailers, just like a lot of the suppliers, have been carrying huge overhead for much of 2023, and overhead that didn't move. So the more we can get out from under that burden of heavy, expensive overhead in terms of inventory, the better it'll be. And that looks like that's beginning for shrimp, which is a really good sign because shrimp is such a big driver in much of the U.S. retail sector. So the other sign that it's mixed right now, but we really need a rebound in the food service sector. Everybody knows seafood performs its best in the high-end portion of the seafood sector, the white tablecloths and casual dining to some degree. But that sector has not recovered to the degree it needs to since COVID. It's got all sorts of issues. But, they include inflation, labor, et cetera. The sectors that are doing better are on the lower end. They're the fast food. McDonald's is crushing it. Fast food and fast casual places. And, seafood doesn't live there very well necessarily. Our neighborhood is really that higher end restaurant. So, we're watching carefully to see what happens here in the next few months to see if things begin to rebound a little bit better. But right now, the signs point to kind of a tough time for the higher end side of food service.
You mentioned salmon, and for years it's been and continues to be the Teflon fish. I mean, when you look at the growth in the inflation in prices for salmon, you would expect a much higher drop off and much more resistance from consumers, but that hasn't really happened. And I think it's just another example of how seafood, as we've talked about for a long time, just lives out, or salmon rather, sorry, lives outside of other parts of the seafood value chain.
Yeah, I mean, here's a quick personal story from the other night. My brother-in-law called me and said, hey, I just had my yearly physical. And he said, news wasn't great. I got to change my diet. And I was, the doctor said, you really got to cut the meats out and the high fats and, bring more seafood into your diet. I said, oh, that's great. He goes, yeah, but I don't know what seafood to really get. He goes, and then he stops himself. He goes, well, I know salmon. I mean, that's great. Salmon I love. I'll always get salmon. But what are the other ones? And I just kind of chuckled. And I'm like, that's to your point right there. It is hit the holy grail, perhaps, of retail in the sense that, and food service to the same degree, in the sense that when you go grocery shopping once a week or how whatever frequency, and you do your big kind of grocery shopping, you invariably grab some ground beef and some chicken, and those just come into your basket because they are staples, right? I think salmon is at that level for a lot of people, and a lot more are headed in that direction. So, yeah, I think I don't see any slowdown for demand in salmon, and depending on where prices come and go, it could even accelerate.
I think it's roundly accepted that the U.S. market is going to be the growth area for it. We don't hear the same excitement about the Chinese market or Southeast Asia, obviously not about Russia, than we used to, a decade ago. Now there's a realization that the U.S. market still has massive room for growth. You are seeing salmon in far more locations, far more retail retailers are carrying it, and far more restaurants that you wouldn't expect. And the producers understand that as well. Chile certainly isn't going to be backing off of the United States anytime soon, nor will Canada, because it's right here on their doorstep. And then Norway is viewing, although it has the European market under its thumb, it is viewing the U.S. as the big growth area. So one quick example of that, or one quick sign of that, the Norwegian Seafood Council, when it released its marketing plan for 2024, the U.S. market now makes up 10% of the total overall budget. That's a budget of nearly $50 million. Across 28 countries, so that's a big chunk of change, and that's being done, on behalf of the industry, not by the individual brands themselves. So that's taking a setting aside Movie's efforts, the Chilean producers' efforts to create brands, of course, Cook, the Faroe Islands companies. There is huge focus here, and regardless what happens with the economy in the U.S. in the coming year, you're going to see a big scramble, big growth, continued big fight for the U.S. market for salmon. So, John, let's stay on salmon, but let's move up to the great state of Alaska and talk about what was probably the most consequential, the most chaotic sea wild salmon season in Alaska in several decades. Kicked off with high inventories, trouble moving last year's or sorry 2022's catch through the market. And then as time went on through the first half of the year, we got more and more signals that this season was going to be dismal and that the prices paid to fishermen were going to be very, very low. So talk us through how that all went and where things are going to be going moving into 2024.
Yeah, to set the table for this, you have to go back to 2022 in Alaska and Bristol Bay, where they had 60 million fish catch, a record. I mean, an astounding record in the sense it was so far past anything they had done before. Okay, a lot of fish. What happened to those fish? Well, they got processed quickly. Quality suffered for a big part of that pack. So they went into cold storage like they normally do, and they were expected to go through the normal distribution channels and, draw down the cold storage and all would be okay, even though it was a big catch. Okay, that didn't happen. Now all the processors are burdened with this massive inventory backlog that they can't get rid of, and then inflation hits. So now they really can't get rid of it because the buyers are like, ah, no, there's nobody's buying seafood. And to top it all off, so much of what they put up was poor quality. They grade them 1, 2, 3. So much was lower 2s and 3s, which, most buyers don't. They're not really that interested in. They're certainly not interested in paying inflated prices for it. So, strapped with this burden, which it's important to point out, has not been lifted completely yet. There is still heavy inventory on a lot of these Alaska processors that the banks are not happy with. The banks have forced them to change some terms for loans that they rely on each year for to get their seasons, get their plants ready, and get everything ready for their season. So, it was not good on the processor side. And obviously, they had to try and get their finances corrected. Their choice was to take that out of the fisherman's pocket, so to speak. So prices for fishermen, which were $1.15 a pound roughly in 2022, have had fallen to 50 cents a pound last year, this past summer. Obviously, fishermen do not take kindly to a haircut of that magnitude. And there were lots of problems. Obviously, it culminated in kind of a protest, if you will, towards the late end of the season. But the bitter feelings and the confusion and the fright as to what will happen in 2024 is all there, and it's all just kind of simmering on the fishermen's side. They don't quite know where things are going. They don't want to see 50 cents again, but it's somewhat out of their hands. So with all that as the backdrop, then we get this amazing bomb in December when we hear that Trident Seafoods, I mean, just the gold star of the Alaska seafood industry, the big guy that everybody respects and looks up to and all that. Out of the blue, they announced they're going to sell off 4 of their plants. Clearly, they were in financial crunch, just like all their brethren, Peter Pan, Silver Bay, etc. And they're trying to right size their balance sheet, just like everybody else. So those plants are now up for sale. As far as we know, nobody's come forward yet. Certainly, there's been no announcement of a deal or anything like that. So obviously, that throws further confusion and doubt in onto the sector and where things are going. We also have reported about a potential merger of one or more processing operations owned by Peter Pan and Silver Bay. That too has not come to fruition yet. We don't know if it will. So it's been a very, very tough year for the Alaska salmon processing sector. A year most people have never seen before, since maybe when was the strike, Drew? Was it the
It's like
90s?
early 90s, yeah.
Early 90s, when things got pretty bad and fishermen just stopped fishing. Now, those days are past. It'd be very hard for a strike to happen again. And in fact, as we monitored the chats of fishermen during the season in social media, it was clear that the majority of them thought strikes were passe in the sense of having any effect on the, you know, changing prices. So there really is no plan on the fishermen's side for affecting prices. Like they talk briefly about, you know, going to the state, getting the state involved in some sort of mediation of prices before the season. Nothing's really come of that. Perhaps it will, but I find it hard to believe it will. But so that's where we stand. So 2024 starts in June, roughly, the major part of the season anyways. And we'll have to see. The good news is the run size for Bristol Bay, which is the key sockeye fishery, largest sockeye fishery in the world, and kind of a price setter in general for the rest of the state as far as other species are concerned. The quota, or not the quota, but the catch is expected to be obviously quite a bit less than that 60 million and more in line with, you know, normal averages. So that's good. That helps the processors, you know, organize their processing better and, you know, protect the catch in the sense of quality. So, yeah, it was something to watch. I honestly, and I should give a tip of the hat to our correspondent, Rachel Sapin, who carried the load on covering that and did just an amazing job. So, it's something to that we'll be watching very closely.
Yeah, dip into our archives if you get the chance, just to catch up on that coverage is fantastic. And nothing is going to change in Alaska unless there's changes in demand, obviously, but probably in product forms and probably looking for new ways to find efficiencies across the value chain. Some interesting efforts we've been tracking, and we'll have more on in the coming weeks, including two of the projects for floating processors up there. I'm really curious how those are going to pan out, and I think the other aspect of this with Trident in particular was that other species could oftentimes offset some of the challenges with salmon, and now, what white knight will be riding into rescue salmon? Well, you know, I don't see people rushing in to buy Trident's plants. I don't see people changing their mindset dramatically on wild salmon consumption unless something changes. Now, the U.S. government has become the largest or one of the largest customers for Alaska products, and that's not a good sign. It's not a good sign when you need the government to be buying up that much of your excess inventory. So so that moves us on to whitefish then. Another chaotic year for whitefish. Now, Russia's invasion of Ukraine 2 years ago was the precursor to a massive shakeup. Alaska pollock is the world's largest single whitefish resource, and split more or less down the middle, a bit more on the Russian side than the U.S. side. Now, having Russia out of U.S. markets and out of at least discouraged from being in certain European markets did have its impact. There's still a lot of efforts to crack down on reprocessing in China to even further reduce the amount of Russian product that gets into the U.S. market in particular. That's been pretty effective. The U.S. Has quite a stranglehold. It already did, but even more of a stranglehold on the U.S. market than it did before. But it's going to continue to cause shifts, especially as the efforts in the European Union to squeeze Russia continue. So, John, some recent developments, just update us on some of the work that Biden's doing and that the U.S. pollock producers are working on to pressure him into.
Yeah, I mean, they were successful, honestly, because recently he moved to expand the executive order from 2022 when Russian origin seafood was banned from the U.S. in the wake of that country's invasion of Ukraine. That was one of the trade hits we put on Russia. However, there was a loophole within that first executive order that did not block Russian origin whitefish, in this case, let's say, that went to China, was reprocessed, quote unquote, double frozen, and sent back to the U.S. market for sale in food service and retail. So that loophole existed. It really raised the ire of Alaska Senator Dan Sullivan and some other lawmakers from the state, in addition to Joe Bundren of Trident. And there's been, you know, probably 6 months of serious pressure on the U.S. government to do something about it. And recently, within the last month, that loophole has been closed. There's still some nuance to it, but it looks like ultimately that reprocessed loophole will be closed. So what we're seeing here is really a remaking of global supply chains, and it's fascinating because this reprocessed fish is important to the U.S. Supply picture. A lot of the processors on the East Coast primarily rely on this fish for making, fish sticks and stuff for retail and for supplying food service chains. For example, Captain D's, one of the largest fast food seafood chains in the country, may be the largest right now. I'm really not sure, but it's big. I want to say 500-600 units, something like that. They've only used Russian product for years and years and years. So a chain like that now has to figure out, well, can I get it from the U.S. guys if I want it? Because the demand now is increasing on the U.S. guys, so there's only a limited supply there. And if I can get it, do I want to pay what they're going to charge? Can I pass that on to my consumers who are, you know, this is fast food. They're expecting, you know, fish and chips for, you know, whatever, $6. I have no idea. But so now what happens there? And what happens with these processors who, you know, a lot of their business is done taking this reprocessed Chinese fish and using it to, you know, for throughput through their plants and everything like that. So, you know, while the Alaskans seem overjoyed about it, I wouldn't say the bulk of the whitefish sector in the U.S. is very happy about it. So it's brought out this kind of antagonism between the two sides, and that's never good in an industry that has trouble uniting on just about any front. So that's never helpful. But yeah, so that's kind of the situation where we are right now, and the current pollock season, the A season as it's called in the U.S. and Russia, is starting here in just a matter of days or so. So we'll start to know a little bit more about things as that product begins to move through the market. I did talk to a couple people because I was wondering, well, what about Lent? You know, Lent is obviously a major time for selling seafood. And fast food chains in particular always bring on a limited time offer in the seafood category, it's generally going to be shrimp, or it's going to be a whitefish sandwich, fillet of fish type sandwich. But I was told most of those purchases are made November, December. So they probably won't be impacted, at least this year, by what's going on. But we'll see. It'll be interesting to see. What I'm looking for is to see if there's a more of an uptick in these limited time offers for Lent that are shrimp based or whitefish based, as they tend to be. So,
well,
we'll see.
Yeah, interesting on the whitefish, and let's look at the raw materials even a little more specifically on whitefish. Now, I mentioned that stat earlier about fish fingers in the UK actually climbing in volume sales. Well, the value per unit of those products actually declined pretty sharply. And why is that? Well, if you dig in the statistics, Nielsen isn't able to really cut it up down into the fine categories yet, but typically Seafish and Nielsen will do that soon to actually tell us what species. But the category other is what grew dramatically. Now, we know that Nomad, which is the owner of Bird's Eye, Igloo, Findus, etc., they made a big commitment to farmed whitefish in the wake of Russia, because the pivot away from Russia, you have to do it. There's too much pressure. Russia, for Western companies anyway, it's a bad look to defend your supply chain if you're using Russian fish. And I think it's become, there's just more and more pressure. So that'll be another interesting shift to watch, as to what extent this sort of revives certain whitefish fortunes like Pangasius, which has been used a lot more in the UK than it was before. Another interesting potential shift that we might see more of in the coming year, and especially as if we do see price inflation with U.S. origin Alaska pollock or with cod, we may see more of that shift. Let's move just along those same lines to the forced labor fallout, an investigation by Ian Urbina and the Outlaw Ocean Project uncovered Uyghur forced labor in several Chinese seafood processing factories. Those have been linked to major U.S. and European countries. Companies rather, and it's still ongoing. Companies they've been scrambling to cut ties, scrambling to find alternatives. How is that fallout going to continue, John? Already we reported earlier this week, Cisco still doing digging through its supply chain. How long does this go on in 2020?
That's tough to say. I mean, certainly, like you mentioned, with buying Russian fish, this is a horrible optic for any seafood company to be connected, tied to in any way, forced labor, as we know. I don't think we've seen the end of it. I feel we're on the backside of it as far as its impact in a big way. I think, you know, once this story broke, most seafood companies that were dealing with any of these companies made moves, to either cut ties or clarify the supply chain or something to that effect. I think one area where we might see the movement is just these, it's just an odd area of third-party certifications that companies use to certify that some of their product coming out of China isn't produced with forced labor or human rights abuses or anything like that. But these audits, I think this story shined a light on how flimsy, I would say, a lot of these audits are. So if you're looking to tackle this problem going forward strategically, I would think something has to be done with the auditing process that's makes it transparent, first of all, and much more robust than what it appears we have right now, because even some of the big companies were using third-party audits, but they either were ineffective or somehow ignored or whatever the case may be. I don't know, but they didn't work, I guess is the short story. So I think that's an area where the story heads next, if in my opinion.
Yeah, I think it's highlighted what maybe a lot of people were concerned about and looked the other way on, which is what is happening with your supply chain, particularly in China. It's one more example of how securing a further stretch across your supply chain from, from the source all the way to the final customer is going to be the way to go for larger companies. It's going to be increasingly a must. And I think that's going to accelerate too, reshoring. It's going to accelerate consolidation, because, this is a trend that was really spiked, obviously, during COVID and has continued the awareness that, okay, maybe having our seafood processed in other countries, China in particular, and going through three or four hands, we don't know necessarily who they all are. Maybe that's not the best way to go because it is eventually going to bite you, and it certainly did. So,
Yeah, but I mean, we're talking about an overhaul of a supply chain that's been, operating smoothly, let's say, for a long time. And as you mentioned, that doesn't happen over. You don't overhaul a global supply chain like seafood
no.
easily or overnight. And so. You kind of got a feel for all the producers and importers and distributors who are trying to navigate supply chain disruption since COVID kicked in 2020. So it's just more of that, but where it ends, I'm not really sure.
Yeah, where do you go, right? Where do you go find somebody else that can process your fish at the cost that you need it to be at? Are there other countries? Some people have looked at Vietnam. There's just, as you know, John, for the past 2 decades, there's been talk that India may rise up or some of these other countries, but finding a way to extricate yourself from China is no easy feat. But there will be some winners, and you're already seeing, I mean, the collapse of many of these reprocessors. More and more and more. We just ran a story about this very thing that you will see a reduction in the reprocessors in China. Now, what I think will happen is you are going to see some people rise up to the top and maybe able to offer more security for people that are processing their fish there, or maybe people do set up shop in the country as well, although even that seems risky. But there's some major companies that have, Japanese companies, Trident Seafoods, for example. But again, I think we're seeing this move towards more control of the supply chain, and I think that's probably good for everyone. And I think that's going to lead to all kinds of changes in the coming year for sure. So just kind of the last topic we'll talk about today, one of our favorites and always an interesting one because of all the change and chaos and promise, and that's land-based salmon. One of the most watched sectors, so in its nascent stages, so many problems. Atlantic Sapphire, of course, is the market leader there, and they had a very, very, very rough year. The CEO and founder, Johan Andreassen, stepped down. And it's been a rough run for the sector, and with that company as sort of the bellwether, the financing really started drying up. And so when we looked at the number of projects, I believe it was roughly 80 when we did a roundup early last year. Many of those are sort of zombie projects where no one will quite admit that they're dead, but they have no financing. And so, you know, what is it beyond just a PowerPoint? And so we're going to see, I think, even more shakeout in 2024, a lot more losers and a few winners rising to the top. Salmon Evolution turned out to be sort of the darling of last year. Now they've partnered with Dongwon, a Korean company that's that is a parent of Starkist and several other companies, and they've also got some partnerships with Cargill and in general, you know, done a good job fundraising. Now they've also actually produced fish, and that's kind of an important thing. To produce fish that tastes good, which is no easy feat to do for a land-based salmon project. But we're going to see Atlantic Sapphire likely continue to struggle because it doesn't seem like there's any major signs that there's going to be a big turnaround. They're going to try to continue what they've promised to do, but obviously investors have backed way off it, and the enthusiasm has really dried up. It's not going away. There's still going to be projects, but I think investors woke up a little bit last year. You see that turning around at all, John? Are we going to get a new spike in interest this year?
We might. I think you're entirely correct. The investors had enough last year, and I mean, just. A quick aside, just to put this in perspective, and I don't want to pick on Sapphire, but at its height, Sapphire's market cap was over $1 billion. As of, I think, November, late last year, that market cap was around $94 million. I mean, that is incredible, you know? I mean, it's shocking, but that kind of sums up the first phase of what I think land-based salmon farming has just completed. I think we've just completed the first phase of this, where it was all that exuberance from an investor point of view. It was a lot of projects, some just on PowerPoint slides, some being developed, and then having to be halted. And so it's just been this tremendous time of growth and experimentation and mad exuberance with money flying everywhere. And boom, we're done with that. I think that period ended hard and fast in 2023. Now we're going into what I think will be the more reasonable period for this technology's development, which is now we see, like you pointed out, now we see who's still standing, who is doing the major critical task of this with this technology, which is producing fish. Hey, look at that, right? So the numbers are still small. We're not talking about any gigantic production numbers, but we're starting to see regular production that isn't continuously interrupted by problems with the technology or whatever it is. So I would think those companies that have achieve that, even on a small scale, and continue to be very careful in how they develop. I think 2024, you're going to see some real separation there, and the losers are going to really sink, and the winners are really going to rise. I don't think this is going to look anything like we thought it was, several years ago when it really kicked off. I think we, you know, there was a lot of thought that this would be a massive industry with lots of quick growth, with these, you know, small farms right near markets and major cities and all that. I think this is going to be a lot smaller than people thought for a lot longer period of time, at least when it comes to salmon.
Agreed. Yeah, and that's a good point. There is at least awareness that there are the fish out there that are suitable, more suitable, to grow and get a premium in the market. So, but
yeah, let's. I mean, salmon are prima donnas when it comes to fish. I mean, they really are. If you're trying to raise them, you know, they like things in a very narrow way, and when those parameters change, they don't react well. They, you know, they get ill, they die, whatever it may be. So there's other species that are not that. You know, not that sensitive, I guess you'd say. So, yeah, maybe that's where another round of growth will be coming from. But let's hope it's not fueled by that crazy investor exuberance without a lot of knowledge like the salmon was.
Well, you know, the industry, the actual industry that's been growing salmon all these years and has been growing smolt on land for all these years, they've been incredibly skeptical. The entire time. I mean, think about Cook CEO Glenn Cook's comments on it. Think about movies' comments on it. There's been plenty of signs and plenty of information warning that this isn't going to be an easy road. Including in our coverage, we've certainly shown that this is not going to be by any stretch of the imagination. An easy time to develop that industry. One thing that we did see in 2023 that I think we'll hear a lot more from, and it's going to, I think, herald the new era for salmon, is going to be offshore farming. Some of this is necessity because of warming waters inshore. In particular, you're seeing this Australia, New Zealand really looking carefully at this. But increasingly, you're seeing projects getting greenlit by people that actually have the money to make it fly, right? So this isn't speculative. We're talking about major industrial projects with major backers that are well-heeled. People like Salmar, Shell Ingaruca, and Aker. These are not small companies, and they don't jump into projects lightly. So we're going to see a lot more interest in that, especially as regulations loosen up in the United States on offshore farming, and in Norway as well, although it's going to be slow, and there's going to be some foot dragging, especially around the tax issue in Norway for offshore farming. I expect that we're going to see more projects announced and more hunting for areas that salmon can be grown offshore, not onshore.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, let's wrap it up there, John. There's way too many other stories that we could hit on from 2023 and way too many other things coming down the pike for 2024, but we've got plenty of time in our coverage on IntraFish.com to look at that. Remember to visit us there and subscribe to our podcast on Apple or Google Play. It's free, but when you do that, every time we produce a new episode, it'll pop right up on your phone, so you'll be able to listen to it right away. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll talk to you next week.